Good evening. Can you hear me? Is this on?
Yes.
Thanks for coming this evening for our rescheduled reading. It was a very snowy evening last week, and so we're sorry that Maggie Glover cannot be with us. Maggie was traveling here from California, so obviously she's going to just linger forever waiting to read with us, but we do have her books for sale. And of course, we're very proud of her as a graduate of our program. But tonight, we're really celebrating two of our faculty, Ethel Morgan Smith and Mark Rosaitis. And although we're always thrilled when our students accomplish something, of course, we take full credit for it. And these two people are definitely part of the success that so many of our students have had. On the back of your, what is this thing called? Program, I guess, that Marcia so beautifully made, are all of our other events. And look how busy we are. And by we, I mean you, too. Including tomorrow afternoon, Sarah Beth Childers, another one of our MFAs alums, will be reading from her first book, 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon in Colson Hall. So I hope some of you will come to that as well. So this evening, I'm turning things over to Rebecca Joverspike, who will introduce Ethel. And we'll enjoy that and then hear from Mark second. Thank you.
Ethel Morgan Smith is the author of From Whence Cometh My Help, the African-American Community at Holland College. Her essay, Love Means Nothing, was the winner of the Mid-Atlantic Arts Prize for Nonfiction. She has published work in African-American Women Writers, the New York Times, African-American Review, and others. She's received several awards, including a Fulbright to teach in Germany, which provided the inspiration for her most recent book, Reflection of the Other, Being Black in Germany. In one passage of Reflections, Ethel evokes mythology to illustrate the power of voice and self-aware identity. She writes, quote, "Though I am not the favorite daughter of anyone like Zeus, nor associated with owl or olive tree, as a black woman, I am always armed." She continues by discussing how Athena mentored younger, more enlightened Olympian gods and helped bring them to power, just as Ethel herself was on a journey of enlightenment. Silence, too, has a role in the power of voice. When she arrives in Germany, Ethel sees, quote, "a tall, slim spruce tree bowed outside my bedroom window. That tree became a kind of quiet angel to her on Sunday mornings when even the rain sounded like silence, and in those moments, her personal history connected to other artists that she carried with her." The narrative of Ethel's time in Germany unravels through a voice aware of its power in articulation and in quiet reflection. Her prose reads musically. On the page and off, Ethel's voice holds authenticity and warmth and acknowledges the need for community. At a vulnerable point in her narrative, she writes that the ego is, quote, "as fragile as tea leaves," and experiences renewal through genuine friendship. Often her questions turn toward the reader and allow us reflective space too, such as in the introduction when she writes, "Is it possible not to be who one has always been?" Her story and teaching invites us to grow into who we are, just as it shows us how she's grown into herself. It's my honor to introduce Ethel Morgan Smith.
Thank you. It is hard to reschedule something, so I'm especially thankful to all of you for coming out the second time. I'd like to say hello to my colleagues. I'm on sabbatical this semester, so I haven't seen myself. So, hello. anyway, what I'm going to do tonight, I'm going to read two pieces for you. So, one, it's February, and it was Valentine's Day, so I wore this red. But it's also Black History Month, and of course, I'm very fond of Black History Month. So what I'm going to do first is read a piece, it is very short, about what happened to me in Germany during Black History Month. Okay. So, the month of February must be Black History Month all over the world by now. Flyers circulated around Wilhelmstrasse near my office advertising that Negro spirituals were going to be sung at the church. I thought the singers were actually going to be black since the flyers showed painted black faces. Lucy Engler told me that she didn't think so. "Why would they paint the faces black then?" I asked. She didn't know, but she warned me not to get my hopes up. I wanted to go anyhow. Even if they weren't black, I was still curious, and maybe they could actually sing. I arrived at the church early and sat in the back, just in case the singing wasn't good. I could ease out without being noticed. Not being noticed in Tubingen wasn't possible, but I pretended it was when I needed to. Sitting in silence overwhelmed me. Grandness and beauty ushered me into a silent prayer. How could it be that this church is so old? When I first arrived in Tubingen in the late golden summer of 1997, I spent the first week with my new colleague, Hauptmuth, and his wife, Ursula. Hauptmuth gave me a personal tour of the church, including the top to the bell tower. Even though I was sick with a cold, it was such a grand welcome. How many others had sat here with hopes and dreams and sorrows? I felt moved with gratitude by the aura of such a space. I love European churches. I grew up in a clapboard white church with a preacher who was called rather than trained. Here, everything was so magnificent. Would I go to church if I had a church like this to attend? I prayed for all those who would never see such a place. I prayed for peace on earth. Who could have dreamed that I, a nice colored girl from Alabama, would be in such a place? I wish that all little black girls could have dreams that would come true. I prayed that my grandmother, who had been dead more than a decade, was looking after me. I hope my friend Alicia and her daughter, who was killed on TWA Flight 800, had had a safe crossing over. My emotions surprised me. I found comfort in the coldness of the church. Program flyers had been placed on the pews. I waited like everyone else, and then it happened. The choir floated in from the side door. Lucy had been right. Okay, I said to myself, listening to see if they could sing. They couldn't. Sitting near the door had been a good idea. I am tone deaf and don't know how to carry a tune, but I could sing better than that choir. Walking out, I didn't even feel guilty. I was too insulted. I walked quickly in the brisk air to my office, laughing at myself. Of course Lucy had been right. I knew it too. Germans don't see her black face like they used on the flyers as racist. Maybe it wasn't on its face. But the problem for African Americans is that history often dictates our emotions. Horace Tongue was working in his office, and I told him what had happened. Are you laughing at me? Of course I'm laughing at you. We ate dinner and drank too much wine. Afterwards, I walked up the hill to my flat and played In the Upper Room by Mahalia Jackson, and thank myself for having a good sense to bring music for my journey. That's Black History Month, baby. Okay, this is a piece, it's part of a bigger piece, and it's in first person, it's fiction, so it's, when I say the I, it's not me. So it's part of a bigger piece. So we'll see how it goes, okay? Okay, so we agreed that there would be no CPT, Colored People's Time. We wanted all the shopping the day had to offer as we sail across rural Alabama with hopes as wide as the pastures we passed. Eve Sharp drove her father's new black Chevy. Her family was in the business of black cars. Black is the color for the dead, she always joked. I was picked up at 7 a.m. We ate breakfast at McDonald's, a real treat since I'd only been there one other time. By 10 a.m. we were at the mall when the doors opened. This was the first time I'd been on a trip without adults. Our first stop was for ice cream at Baskin and Robbins, 31 flavors. I couldn't imagine so many flavors. I only knew chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla. Ruth ordered vanilla. Make sure I know what I'm getting. She licked her ball of heaven. Me too, chocolate, Eve said. Cherry, I ordered, feeling adventurous. All of the flavors were as pretty as rainbows. We sashayed around, giggling, window shopping. Eve found her dress first at a store called 579. She was petite and hadn't rocked herself into a color scheme. We cheered and told her she looked good enough to be on TV. Ruth White was sure she wanted a white lace dress, maybe one that could be her wedding dress later on. The church ladies always shopped at Bloomberg's. Some even had accounts, but mostly they appreciated the good service and the credit that was extended to them. The fashions weren't flashy, but of good quality. Beauty told me the Bloomberg family were Jews, and they knew what it felt like to be treated badly for no reason. Only the family worked there. They'd got no big business back in them. Miss Louise, our neighbor and church lady, said, like she was their best friend. I never understood what she meant by them being Jews. Mr. Odell would know. He knew everything. It wasn't right that the smartest teacher was fired just because he wanted to talk to people, talk to us about sex. I liked him. He talked to us about how we could change the world. What was wrong with that? I wanted to scream out to the world. I managed to save $25 from working at the white woman's house after school. The best part of working at the white woman's house was I got to read Time magazine every week after she tossed it in the trash can. I read a lot about the race problem and the civil rights workers. Finally, I found an A-line taffeta spaghetti strap dress just below the knee line. I looked so glamorous. The church ladies would object to the scraps and hemline. A big grin spread over my face. Later, I bought a pair of white satin shoes and a clutch purse. Last fall, I had ordered some sweaters from Sears and Roebuck catalog. Mail ordering was one way of not having to be in contact with mean white folks. If I could just understand why we were so hated, what had black folks done to them? Everybody I knew was hardworking Christians. The reality of hating people was too painful. Sometimes I felt ashamed that more people didn't stand up to them about our rights. I wondered what white folks thought about since they had so much free time not having to think about being black. In Bloomberg, rich scarves of red and white were in stored old-fashioned glasses. The perky clerk offered us lots of tips on mixing and matching our clothes. Fashion's only an illusion, she kept repeating. Pointing to lovely ladies' lingerie, Eve and Ruth giggled. I hear a lot of girls lose their virginity on prom night, I said. I did, the clerk said. Really? I wanted to ask her all kinds of questions, like, how do you learn to do it? And how do you know if you're doing it right? Are you supposed to talk? What was it like? She popped from behind the counter, peeped around to make sure no one was in the dressing room. Well, it hurts a lot at first. It's a layer of skin. It's called a cherry. It's broken. It could even be, well, a little wet. She made a face like she had tasted a green plum. She did a good job of using her mysterious eyes and her long fingers to help tell the story of doing it. Gross, Ruth White frowned. You'll get used to it. Just make sure you have a nice soft towel. She placed her hands over her heart. What does it smell like? Eve asked. Casual, like your bodies. She smiled. Does it ever stop hurting? I hate pain. I've been doing it for about a year now, and it doesn't hurt as much. But don't be scared, the clerk said with authority. Really? Ruth gasped. Not nearly as it did in the beginning. Were you embarrassed the next time you saw it? Eve asked. A little. But that's why it's important to be in love with the person. Otherwise, it'll be just sex and pain. Somebody is coming, Ruth yelled. Remember, if you give him too much, it won't be special. Make him beg a little and give you chocolate often, was the last advice that the clerk had time to offer us. We thanked her and laughed. Our audience had lost its zip after the sex lesson. Ruth was the only one who hadn't found a dress. I thought she was being too picky. She finally called home, and her mother gave her permission to use her Bank AmeriCard to treat us for dinner. We proceeded to the Great Wall, a Chinese restaurant in Eufaula, where the waiters knew Ruth White's name. It was time like those that I didn't like her that much. She always took over and ordered for everybody. But what I didn't understand was how she was so dumb. Her mother taught school, and her father was the best carpenter in Barber County. I always thought that smart people produce smart children, another theory that didn't work. We waited for our orders of chicken with garlic salt, spicy shrimp, and peppers. Do you think we'll lose our virginity on prom night? I blurted out. The only time I'm going to lose my virginity is on my wedding night. Charlie Frank knows I don't play. Eve looked at her menu. Me too. I may let Johnny get to first base, but kissing will be the only exchange of body fluids, Ruth White said. I haven't even kissed Emmett yet. What will happen if things get hot and heavy, I asked. Gracie Mae. Only guys get hot and heavy. The waiter returned. Thank you, we said at the same time, but didn't speak again until he left. I don't believe that. "What do you think the girls are doing while the guys are getting hot and heavy?" I whispered. "Only whores are supposed to like it," Ruth White whispered back. "It seems pretty gross to me," Eve said. "We ought to send off some of those books," I said. "What books?" "The ones that you get in the mail wrapped in brown paper. I knew this from reading a white woman's romance magazines." "We don't have time. The prom is going to be less than 2 weeks. We still could order the book. Sex will come up again." I was proud of my true romance magazine knowledge. I didn't always understand everything in the magazines. Plus, one time I had the measles. Big Mama let me watch the soap opera, The Guiding Light. I tell you, it was all about love and trouble. The waiter appeared with our fortunes. I opened mine first. I wasn't in the mood to hear one of Ruth's stories. "You're going to lose your virginity," I read out loud. "Really? You ought to stop it." "Well, we could, you know. Just can't let it go, can you, Gracie? Why can't we have some fun?" "What are you talking about now?" Eve Sharp sighed. "We could guess who's going to lose their virginity. That sounds too much like gambling. And when you get right down to it, it's none of your business. You sound like the church ladies. This is our one and only prom. Just remember, I took care of my sister last summer. I know where this can lead." "Where?" I wanted nothing more than to know what had happened to Eve's sister last summer. I hated secrets. "We ain't ready to go there," Eve stirred her sweet tea. I shook her head. "I heard once you start doing it, you can't stop," Ruth White said. "Sure, I want to have a good time on prom night, but I don't think it's necessary to go against the Lord. And I'm sick of Gracie talking about that crazy white girl." "She wasn't crazy. No one has ever told us anything about what to expect the first time. We get the same advice. Keep your skirt down." "Let's get going." Ruth picked up the check and headed out. We followed like a small procession. A calm, starless night had stolen the light of day. "I told my mother what time we'll be leaving," Ruth White said. "That's a good idea." "Don't worry. We don't have to be afraid. White folks are scared of anything having to do with the dead. We never get stopped. And if we do, they let us go real fast." We laughed. Ruth out. Eve gunned the car toward the main highway. "Thank God they're afraid of something," I said. We had started to get on each other's nerves and had no reserves. After Ruth White fell asleep, we drove in silence for a bit. Eve found the soul radio station. A cold streak sky looked like a bruised sunset rising from the dark night. "I really like your dress," Eve said. "Thank you. I like yours too. Someday we'll be together by the Supremes played on the radio." And we joined in. "My love is yours, baby. Oh, right from the stars. You possess my soul. Now, honey, and I know, you own my heart." Ruth faded out of her sleep with her silky voice. And I want to say, someday we'll be together. When the song ended, Eve was about to turn the radio off. But we interrupt this program to bring you a special report. Reverend Martin Luther King has been killed in Memphis, Tennessee. "Oh my God, this is terrible," I said, covering my face with shaking hands. "What does this mean?" Eve asked. "It means we have even more of a reason to be afraid of white folks." "You know, I just thought of who? Dr. King?" Ruth sat up from the back. "Mr. Odell," she said. "Me too. I miss him so much," I said. "I thought about him because I heard he got fired for marching with Dr. King," Ruth said. "Really? That makes sense. I wonder what he's doing now. He could even be dead too," Eve said. "Please don't say that." Fear took the steering wheel as the black car sailed through the starless night and slammed us into an uncertain future. Thank you.
Last semester in Mike Rosaitis' workshop, he pointed out a pivotal piece.
this judgmental, this cruel? It took me 2 days of stewing and petting the cat instead of writing to realize that he was right. And it helped me more than anything to feel redirected, to recognize that the biggest trick to writing fictional work is writing fiction that's true. And just as Mark's voice is an anchor in Workshop, it is a beautiful anchor in his writing. In Mark's work, whether we are considering young Guatemalan love or the fate of an officer of the law who is losing his wife, we know, as Mark treating audience, that his voice knows the truth that's buried in the confusion of the fictional world. It's an honor as an outgoing MFA student to introduce Mark. I've gone through 3 semesters of workshops with him and plenty of thesis chapters. I've dropped in on his office unannounced with some bizarre worry. I've sent him panicked emails to my fiction undergraduate classroom flooded only a couple weeks ago. And what I've learned is that Mark is an anchor of logic and truth in every sense, and it's a gift when anyone gets to hear such magic out loud.
Thank you all for coming to this rescheduled event. I want to thank my colleagues in creative writing, Ethel. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for wearing red. I should have thought of that, right?
Girls
think.
Yes.
And thanks to Jim and Marianne and Kevin and Alyssa and Glenn and Marcia who prepared this event and participated in the preparation of this event. So thank you. I felt bad that we had to cancel because Maggie came all the way from some distant location, Maggie Glover, to be here. The wise heads prevailed, and we did not send you out through the ice. Probably you wouldn't have come through the ice or snow, and we would have read to snowmen, which would have been fine, but they would have listened, but they wouldn't have bought books. So I thought I'd read one of Maggie's poems. It's called Sunday Before Grocery Shopping. The cat dips into the aquarium, paws the old goldfish, and you let her, for a little while, pushing another cold forkful of eggs into your mouth. This is how you govern your body, this and oily vitamins, frequent trips to the marine park, quick naps on the couch. You are tired of waiting for me, and I am tired of waiting, hunched in the yard, both hands in the garden, watering the places where something could grow, if I thumbed them right, the hose quivering in the grass like the snakes we are both afraid of, you of their movement, me of their bite. So that's Maggie, and I guess her books are on sale over there, so that's great. I thought I'd start out with a couple of my poems. Is my wife here?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. Okay, then I'm going to adjust my reading accordingly. In my poetry class, my 213 class, we read a poem about, Kimetta Nazir's poem about Snow White, and it's a very devastating book. And the true story behind Snow White. And I wanted to share with them, which I did, a retelling of a fairy tale that wasn't so devastating. And this is called Prince Charming's. This is called Prince Charming's Confession. I never thought my father would agree to our marriage. She was, after all, little more than a servant girl. But he was eager, as he announced, to see me settle down, though I think the real reason was because he suspected my secret and was desperate to conceal it in the white smoke of matrimony. I should have skipped town before my wedding day, but I figured she, who grew up scrubbing floors, would want what I wanted, a top-down revolution, pearls and porcelain to the peasants' pitchforks in the hearts of the powdered and pampered, and would pardon my lack of interest in producing an heir in exchange for an equal share of power. But when on our honeymoon night I decried the proletariat's pain, she looked at me as if I was a talking mouse. She cracked a smile and said, come to bed, my liege, and show me some noblesse oblige. I had to plead first night jitters and a lingering injury from a polo shot too close to my groin. She sulked in satin sheets as I paced on the patio. At last, I heard her liberating snores. With money, it's easy to flee. I stopped to pick up Prince Eric at the border, though now he tells me he might be by, kind of, sort of, sometimes Mrs. Ariel, despite her briny smell. Back home, Cinderella's turned tyrant. Her old lady's in jail. She ordered her stepsisters guillotined. My old man is living out his twilight in a cottage behind the castle. She has him over for tea on Tuesdays to pick his mind on affairs of state. And while she treats him with the respect an ex-monarch in his dotage deserves, she can't help but joke about his misfortune. She told him she wouldn't call herself queen. She was saving the title, she said, for me. What do I care? I'm sitting by the pool, I'm drinking a daiquiri, and here comes Lancelot, shedding his knight's hosiery and giving me the eye. You tell me, who has the fairy tale painting? My beautiful wife, who's here. We've talked a little bit about what it means to see our kids off to college, out of the nest, and it's heartening to know that when you're staring across the dinner table at someone and you think about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and you still want to stare at that person. Sorry, I'm choking up. But this is a love poem for her. Ethel, thanks for wearing red. Love. Let's not say hello. Let's not say hello every time we meet. Next time, let's nuzzle each other on the chin like koala bears after a eucalyptus spin. The time after this, let's faint at gouging each other's eyes like the Three Stooges. You harumph, and I'll say, neck, neck, neck. When we meet on Fridays, let's link arms and do a 2-minute spin, singing a celebratory ballad in Celtic. And since we don't know a Celtic ballad, let's approximate one. The first line would go like this: Friday, 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 oh yeah, yeah. If we meet in a place we never thought we'd meet, let's pretend we don't see each other. You look right, and I'll look right. You crawl, and I'll jump. You kiss the sky where my head touched, and I'll kiss your knee prints. If it's Sunday morning when we meet, let's acknowledge a higher power by drawing mandala wheels on our shoes. When our artistry goes awry, and they look like hieroglyphs, let's pretend they're landing instructions for aliens. Let's go into a cornfield. If we meet within 50 yards of water, let's greet each other with gurgles and blub dub dubs. I'll call you Angelfish, if you'll call me Jaws. If on occasion one of us slips and says hello, the other must undo the greeting by saying hello backwards, turning the H into the opening note of an opera. We'll whistle until someone drops a quarter at our feet. If we meet in the dark, let's fling our clothes aside but leave on our socks. Puppets who can perform the prelude of small talk and yearning, who can even afterward say goodbye. We, on the other hand, must never say goodbye. I lived in Guatemala for about 3.5 years. And that, for a long time, I thought that's all I would write about, since it was such a fertile territory for me as a writer. But I eventually stopped doing that after 4.5 books. I guess it took that long to get it out of my system. But what I thought was 4.5 books, because the book I ended up publishing recently, I began, believe it or not, in graduate school about 3 years ago when I was in graduate school. It's been a while. And I give this talk sometimes called How to Write a Novel in 100 Days. Talk about false advertising. So it's taken this long, and not just in the writing of it, but of course in getting it published. Because as one agent said to me, who wants to read a love story about two Guatemalan teenagers? I do. I wrote it. But Guatemala, again, was a fertile ground for my writing, and it was particularly to tell the kind of story I wanted to tell, which is a Romeo and Juliet story, because there's so much dividing people in that country, particularly when the Civil War was going on. It ended in 1996, but it had been going on for 36 years before that. And you have Catholics on one hand, Protestants on the other, the indigenous population on one hand, and a Ladino, a Spanish-descended population on the other hand. You had a small group of intensely, hugely wealthy people versus a majority that were poor. So there's so many divisions in this country that it just called for the kind of story that would bridge those divisions somehow, or see if those divisions could be bridged by love. And that's what I set out to write, and 15 years later, ta-da, a book. I'll read a few selections. Julian Rodrigo, which is a novel. This is the opening. Julia hears him before she sees him. At the end of the Flor de Mayo pageant, as Ingrid Estrada strolls down the red carpeted floor with her crown glittering in the gymnasium lights, he yells his displeasure. Why do the Blanquitas always win? He follows with a chant, black, black, black. His words seem to turn Ingrid Estrada even whiter. Dark skinned, although more rich earth color than black, he is standing near the two open doors at the back of the gymnasium. Julia knows who he is, Rodrigo, Rodrigo Rash. She has known him most of her life. They are in the same class now at El Instituto Básico. But she has never heard him speak in such a firm, commanding voice. His voice is like a light shining on what else is attractive about him. His broad shoulders, his strong jaw, his large, expressive eyes. Julia is sitting in an aisle seat, her body turned toward him. When his gaze moves from Ingrid Estrada to her, she holds her breath. The expression on Rodrigo's face turns from disgust to delight. Julia returns his smile, and he winks at her. Rodrigo finishes his protest with exuberant laughter, and he and the heavyset man standing next to him depart into the night. As if trying to protect the audience from their return, Guillermo, the ticket taker, closes both doors behind them. They shut with a bang bang like two gunshots. But even as Julia watches Ingrid finish a walk back to the stage and accept kisses from the six judges, she hears the echo of Rodrigo's voice. It is hard to see Ingrid as she did a minute before as a girl with flowing black hair and shining morning skin. She sees instead a girl who is so pale as to look ill. She sees her hair as a witch's cape. Ingrid waves goodbye and a final applause is soft and brief. People are quick to leave the gymnasium, escaping into the cool night. The sky is bright, the stars. Julia walks under the roof of the Municipalidad and past Santa Cruz's lone payphone. She is about to step into the street when she sees Rodrigo across it, sitting on a stool at Tienda Esperanza, a white wooden stand decorated with Coca-Cola emblems. Next to Rodrigo sits the man he was with in the gymnasium, Pedro Mendez, who appears often in her father's warnings of what most men in their hearts are like. Pedro is known to have fathered two children with women in town he never married. Julia hides behind one of the Municipalidad's thick columns, her head craning from behind it so she can observe them. Her heartbeat quickens from the excitement of spying. Ingrid Estrada isn't the whitest girl I know, Pedro says. In the capital, I know dozens of gringos. Blonde-haired gringos, red-haired gringos, even a gringo who dyes her hair pink and green. I don't like gringos, Rodrigo says. I like Guatemaltecas, dark eyes, dark hair, dark skin. Very patriotic, Pedro says. Rodrigo and Pedro face each other on their stools. They are both drinking from bottles. Beer, Julia guesses. She watches Rodrigo lift the bottle to his lips. She wonders how it tastes. She imagines it tasting like honey and something bitter. Julia knows her father would be waiting for her. It's past 10 o'clock and her father wanted her home by 9:30. How long were you in the capital this time? Rodrigo asks. 6, 7 months, Pedro says. 2 days before I left, I was in Disco Tropical when a bunch of soldiers from the United States came. They didn't have their uniforms on. They had crew cuts. They were gringos, so I knew who they were. One of the soldiers was talking to a certain muchacha. The boyfriend didn't like it, so he sliced the soldier's neck. Blood everywhere, boss. People were slipping in blood. Did he die? The newspaper said he was in the hospital, critical condition. Pedro drinks from his bottle. The soldier never imagined Disco Tropical would be his Vietnam. Pedro laughs and shakes his head and drinks. So the Americans are here to fight the war, Rodrigo asks. None of us, only to train and advise the army, to teach better ways to kill. Rodrigo sits from his bottle before returning to the counter. What would you do if you were forced to join the army, Rodrigo asks. I'd run, boss. Once you're in the army, you're dead, even if you don't die. Your head voice is never the same. Pedro pauses to drink. And you, Vos? Yes, I run too. Rodrigo finishes what's in his bottle. They sit in silence for a while before Rodrigo turns on the stool and looks down the street. I have to go, he says. My mother is waiting. Rodrigo shakes Pedro's hand, says goodnight, and leaves his stool. Julio watches him walk down Avenida La Parroquia and reach the part of the road where the concrete ends. Because he is wearing a black t-shirt and black slacks, he easily merges with the darkness. Pedro turns around on his stool to face the street, and Julia quickly moves her head behind the column. She hopes he hasn't seen her, but a moment later he calls, "Who are you looking for, senorita?" A few seconds later he adds, "Come here, I have something to show you." The streets are empty, and Julia fears Pedro will leave his stool, push her into the shadowed doorway of the Municipalidad, and do with her what he wants. But although she's afraid, she doesn't run. When a minute later she again ventures a look from behind the column, Pedro is gone. The light from within Tienda Esperanza glows on the empty stools. The woman behind the counter standing against the back wall, her eyes closed. Julia leaves her hiding place and looks down the street where Rodrigo lives. The moon hangs above the mountains beyond it. She imagines walking down the street to Rodrigo's house. She imagines listening at his bedroom window and overhearing his nighttime prayers. She imagines him speaking her name. Leaping ahead, Rodrigo is a soccer player, and the character of Rodrigo is based a little bit on my friend Pablo Rosch, who did play professional soccer until quite recently and then has founded a soccer school for young people. It is Rodrigo's 18th birthday when he receives the telegram from the Coban Imperiales. He reads it three times, each time without understanding anything except this: he is a professional soccer player. There is no one in his house with whom to share the news. His brothers are at school, his mother in the market. He is supposed to be getting ready to go to Colegio Vera Paz in Coban, but he hasn't attended classes in several weeks. If he does take the bus to Coban before classes start in the afternoon, it is only to accompany Julia. Now he'll be able to quit school. Although, this isn't what makes him dance around his house, pretending chairs and tables are stone-legged opponents, and the back door is the goal mouth. He looks at his watch and realizes he is late to meet Julia at the bus stop in the park. He dashes outside, his hair wild from the celebration. He races up his street, picking up speed as the dirt gives way to concrete. The bus across Calle Principal is painted like a rainbow, and Rodrigo thinks this is right. He has been delivered a pot of gold. He is about to cross the street when he notices Julia sitting on the bus beside an open back window. She is looking straight ahead, as if expecting him to walk any second down the aisle. "Here, Julia," he shouts as the bus starts moving. "I'm here." He fails to look both ways before crossing the street, but he's lucky. No cars are coming, and soon he is jogging next to the bus beneath Julia's window. "Right here, Julia, I'm right here." The bus rumbles over a speed bump, and its groaning prevents Julia from hearing him. As the bus picks up speed, he is worried he'll have to wait until she returns in the evening to tell her his news. But he keeps pace with the bus, and at last she notices him, her face brightening. She calls his name, and he knows he doesn't have much time before the bus will reach the steep downhill slope of the road and roar off to the Coban Highway. "I'm a professional," he shouts, holding up the telegram. "Paid to play." He falls a step behind. "Marry me, Julia. You will, won't you?" She waves, but whether in affirmation of his proposal, in celebration of his professional status, or only in goodbye, he isn't sure. He stops and watches the bus wind down the last stretch of Calle Principal, meet the Coban Highway, and disappear. So Rodrigo's soccer career is interrupted by an injury, and his team replaces him and doesn't continue paying him a salary, so he's forced to take a job and a coffee thinker picking coffee beans off the plants. And this is that scene. When they started work on the finca a month before, Rodrigo and Galindo talked as they picked coffee, speculating about the lives of their fellow workers, and especially the plantation owner. Don Rauher's wife died in childbirth, but he soon became her twin sister's novio. Although they have stopped talking about the lives of their fellow workers, which like theirs are dominated by heat and rain, Don Rauher continues to interest them. His wife's sister is pregnant, his baby, but she refuses to marry him. She feels ashamed because he's her sister's husband, Rodrigo says. He'll always be her sister's husband, even if her sister's dead. Crazy girl, Galindo says. She should marry him. They fall silent and pluck the beans. Rodrigo thinks about soccer and Julia and how while he might have lost soccer, at least temporarily, he won't lose Julia. He thinks about their wedding date a week away. He thinks about how he will surprise her when he brings her, not to his house, but to the house in Coban he showed her long ago. He has saved enough money to rent it for 3 months. He concentrates on his right foot and feels it in the dirt. He feels the warmth of the dirt touch the center of his foot, then spread, soothing his ankle. He imagines the ground as God's balm, and the wind through the coffee plants as his incantation healed. Heal, heal. Even as the day turns cooler and clouds gather in the west, Rodrigo feels the heat on his foot. Another few weeks, at most another month, then he'll try running. Running like he would on a soccer field with the fury of wind. The rain comes, but soft, cheepy, cheepy. Rodrigo and Galindo work another 20 minutes until they see their fellow workers, men, women, and children, descend from the curving hills. The men are dressed like Rodrigo and Galindo in t-shirts and faded slacks, ragged on the ends and spotted with holes. The women wear faded dresses and cortes stained the color of coffee. The children seem to be barely dressed at all. Rodrigo and Galindo carry their baskets to the barn and dump the contents onto the concrete floor. In the morning, they will move the beans to a patio outside to dry. The workers, about 40 in all, walk toward the gate. The children are especially tired, their steps slow and labored. Rodrigo and Galindo walk near the back of the group. Rodrigo is in no hurry. He knows Julio will be studying tonight. After dinner, he will meet Pedro and have a beer with him. Or perhaps he'll go into his courtyard with his soccer ball and sit on a chair and bounce the ball on his left foot, his good foot, seeing how long he can keep it from hitting the ground. Before they make a final turn around the hill to the gate, they hear shouts. Men and women rush by them, suddenly animated. What's wrong? Rodrigo asks Galindo, but even as he does, Galindo begins to run. Rodrigo feels his ankle sting as if bitten by a dog, and he feels his leg ache. He compensates by shifting his weight to his good foot. Now, he tells himself, his command in soccer when he wanted to race past an opposing player, but as he's about to fly, he feels something dull and heavy slam against his right shoulder, and he sees the ground bend. He hits the earth and rolls. He's on his back, and he isn't able to stand before two soldiers converge over him, their rifles pointed at his gut. He closes his eyes and wishes himself into Julia's living room. He loves the feeling of sitting close to her, smelling her hair, listening to the ripple of her laughter. But he sees her father's shadow on the orchid patterned curtain covering the window. He never knows when her father will step into the room to interrupt a kiss. In the back of the canvas-covered truck, Rodrigo sits on a bench across from six soldiers. They wear camouflage and hold rifles between their legs. You didn't run fast enough, one tells him. A strong boy like you and you didn't run fast enough. Another soldier says, he ran fast, but I'm faster. Liar. Your mother voice. The two soldiers stand as if to confront each other, then sit down, laughing. Angry? The first soldier asks Rodrigo. Rodrigo doesn't reply. The soldier laughs. The truck jiggles. Rodrigo wonders how he can escape. He would rather be shot in the back than become a soldier. Sad, the first soldier asks. Rodrigo stares at him. He's sad, the first soldier announces, and the other soldiers laugh. Let me just read a happier thing to end tonight's event on. But thank you for listening. That was early in the book, believe it or not. This is a love poem to getting older. It's called 40th Birthday, a lament, a celebration. And of course, my 40th birthday was just a few days ago. 40th birthday, a lament, a celebration. Thank you all for coming tonight. And I wish my mom were here because it looks like they have a lot of books and she would help with sales. You will never be president of anything except perhaps the big underwear society, because as your oldest daughter proclaimed the other day at breakfast, you have the biggest bum in the world. You will never be carded by anyone but the most officious nightclub bouncer or the most ingratiating liquor store clerk. You will never win the Yale series of younger poets, although you will be sure, pretty sure, at least 0.1% sure, you would have won the prize this year had you been eligible. You will never be called a prodigy. You will, however, be called prodigious, an appetite, for example, most likely by your older daughter when she learns the word. You will never walk the hallways of a high school and be mistaken for a student. You won't know what's cool anymore. You won't even know if the word cool is cool anymore. You will be 95% certain that cool still means on the cold side. Your ex-lovers will no longer haunt you with their youthful beauty. They will haunt you with their mature beauty and their inherited wealth. You will at last understand your grandparents. You will miss them even more. As your hold on the earth becomes day by day more tenuous, it becomes more tender. What you're left hurting, you vow to heal. You will rise earlier and earlier every morning, and one especially early morning, when you're feeling especially good, the kind of good you never felt before at this hour, except perhaps in dreams, you will call yourself the Rooster. And you will whisper, cock-a-doodle-doo, to the adoring mirror. You will attempt the same performance that night in your bedroom in front of your wife with a couple of muscle flexes thrown in. You are 98% certain she will shake her head, though, with a smile and turn off the light. You will gamble, of course, on the 2%. You've already lost 40 years, but you still feel lucky. Thank you all for coming.
Elisa High, or Ellie to my friends, and so I'm just old Ellie, and I'm the oldest member of the creative writing at 40. Of course, I just passed that myself. But, you know, I think these readings by colleagues are very special, and as I've gotten older here, you've already heard what wonderful writers they are, but they're also wonderful teachers, and I think having the folks who introduced them tonight, you could tell that. But I'd like to mention one other thing that has become more important to me over the years. And it's really important what kind of human beings I think we all are. And I think for writer teachers, it becomes especially difficult. I know it's been difficult for me. Trying to teach and trying to write and trying to have something of your own life. It's just hard, but it's wonderful. But it wouldn't happen if it weren't for friends and colleagues. And so I live on an old farm and I have bees. And I thought this would fit, it's not moonshine, I know you all hope it. We'll keep quiet about that side of the farm. You know, honey is the only natural food that never goes bad. And it's pretty marvelous. You know, and this little jar here is literally hundreds of thousands of blossoms and thousands of miles that those little bees want to make this happen. And it's probably the best, you know, right here, I'm holding in my hand some of the sweetness of my life right here. And certainly the sweetness of my work at WVU is because of my friends. And these are two great friends of mine. And so I'd like to give each one of them, because to me, they're not only friends, but they're really great human beings. And Ethel, this is for you. You know, you're always an inspiration to me. I'm always amazed by your energy. And you've just been a wonderful friend. So this is for you. And Mark, I've never adequately thanked you for all the work you've done for creative writing. To me, you've been a very generous friend. And I'm hoping, I've read some of his work on Guatemala. I hope to be going there myself this summer. And he's given me lots of good information, but just a really wonderful, generous friend. And for that, I'm really thankful. Thank you.